Hi, and thanks for turning on The Blender, the weekly podcast from Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Get ready to sit back and enjoy an energizing mix of protein-rich news and fat-free analysis. I'm Daisy Sindelar, a writer at RFERL, and I'll be your host this week. In this week's Blender, we commemorate the 100-year anniversary of International Women's Day by looking at the roles of women in Afghanistan, Uzbekistan, and Chechnya.
Women play a very important role in Chechen society. Chechen woman has always got an equal rights like men has.
We also talked to RFE correspondent Abubakar Siddiq about the mounting violence in Pakistan and why the Taliban militia remains a threat despite attempts to curb its influence.
Their ability to control large territories has been downgraded, but they are very capable of pulling off spectacular attacks, which usually results in large-scale killing of civilians.
Finally, well, we'll leave you to wonder about that one. And now, Russia. When it comes to prospects for change, the country may be light years away from Egypt and other Middle Eastern countries challenging their long-serving tyrants. But that hasn't stopped a group of opposition leaders in Russia from forming the country's newest liberal party. Radio Free Europe's Gregory Pfeiffer spoke to one member who hopes to become the first presidential candidate to challenge the Kremlin on behalf of a united opposition.
A new political movement promises to unite Russia's fractious opposition to challenge the Kremlin. It's happened so many times since Prime Minister Vladimir Putin took power more than a decade ago, you'd be forgiven for wondering why you should notice. Still, Vladimir Milov says a brand new party he co-founded last year has a duty to run in parliamentary elections in December and a presidential vote next year.
This means that for a long time ahead, this is basically the last chance to have a fair dialogue about the country's future and to resolve the problems which Russia is facing through civilized manner.
Tall, handsome, and well-spoken at age 39, Milov is the newest poster boy for Russia's liberal opposition. A former deputy energy minister often seen on the front lines of protests against the authorities. And he's ambitious. Milov wants to become the first presidential candidate to challenge the Kremlin on behalf of a unified opposition. But he'll have to overcome overwhelming odds if he wants to succeed even in registering to run. Opposition parties are routinely denied registration, banned from state media, and even if they manage to run in elections, snowed under by ballot stuffing. Still, Milov says the opposition has a duty to try.
So a great majority of people who want and demand changes in Russia, they want to see a new political party which makes an attempt to participate in the election. They want to have a chance to see a new democratic opposition party on the ballot.
Milov and other Kremlin critics are taking heart from what they see as a change in public attitudes. A sluggish recovery from the global financial crisis, strong-armed authoritarianism, and massive corruption are prompting more people to criticize the government, even if their numbers are still small. A poll by the independent Levada Center shows Russians equally divided between those who believe their country is moving in the right direction and those who think it's going the wrong way, 42% each.
The crucial point right now is that the job of opposition is to talk to people, reach out directly to people, find the ideas and the language which will be found acceptable and which will be supported by the Russian population, and get more and more new supporters. Basically, this is what the People's Freedom Party project is all about.
Pressed about how the new party will be any different from its predecessors, Milov says traditional groups, such as the Liberal Yabloko Party, have been ineffective because they try to negotiate with the Kremlin. While newer movements, such as the Other Russia, led by chess master Garry Kasparov, aimed at fomenting color revolution-style street protests without any effort to educate the electorate. Still, Milov's co-leaders are veterans of some of those predecessor groups. Yeltsin-era reformer Boris Nemtsov, former parliament member Vladimir Ruskov, and ex-prime minister Mikhail Kasyanov. Political analyst Kirill Rogov says among them, Milov represents a new face in Russian politics.
He began as an expert, a technocrat in government, before making a conscious decision to enter politics. That was an unfashionable, unusual career choice.
As deputy energy minister in 2002, Milov spearheaded a plan to reform the state natural gas monopoly, Gazprom. But he quit the government after Putin vetoed his plan. He's since worked closely with his mentor Nemtsov, helping form an opposition group called Solidarity. But Milov left Solidarity last year after falling out with its other leaders, which doesn't bode well for his hopes to rally the opposition. Another Solidarity co-founder, veteran human rights activist Lev Ponomarev, criticizes Milov's call for Russia's opposition to abandon universal values in favor of what he calls a liberal nationalism.
Milov is an expert, a theorist, a good expert, but when he was in Solidarity, I could see he can't handle organizational work.
Still, Ponomarev believes the People's Freedom Party represents the best chance to unite the opposition. But while he agrees public dissatisfaction is mounting, he says that won't necessarily translate into support for the opposition.
Unhappiness may be growing, but when they are asked whom they'll vote for, Russian voters name only two people, Putin and Medvedev, those they see on television.
As for Milov's presidential hopes, analyst Rogov says in the era of Putin, talk about his candidacy at this point is only that. It's a gesture, he says, not a real political possibility. Gregory Pfeiffer, RFERL, Prague.
You're listening to The Blender, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's new weekly podcast. And now to Pakistan, where the start of March has brought a wave of brutal violence. The country's only Christian cabinet member, Minority Affairs Minister Shahbaz Bhatti, was assassinated March 2nd. And the Pakistani Taliban has since claimed responsibility for two suicide bombings that together claimed the lives of more than 60 people. Ron Sinovitz sat down with fellow RFE correspondent and Pakistan specialist Abubakar Siddiq to talk about the situation.
Abubakar, recently we've seen a series of news developments in Pakistan that suggests the situation there is deteriorating on several fronts. Can you explain to us, please, what's happening in Pakistan today?
I think there are a number of things happening. One, that the violent campaign by the Pakistani Taliban and other militant groups is kind of increasing. We recently have seen a number of bombings and assassinations. The most high-profile assassination was, of course, the assassination of Shahbaz Bhatti, Pakistan's only Christian cabinet minister and the minister for minority affairs. There was a suicide bombing yesterday, March 8, and there was a suicide bombing again today, March 9, killing scores of people in northern parts of Pakistan, but also in the increasingly destabilizing eastern part of Pakistan. And then we have the Pakistani-American relations, which are also deteriorating sharply.
Now, in the Pakistan-American relationship, one of the controversial issues is the trial of Raymond Davies. The State Department says that he should have diplomatic immunity, but in Pakistan, they're saying that it's up to Pakistani courts to decide this. Can you bring us up to date on the status of this?
I think it's an ongoing court case in Pakistan. What has happened is that ever since this issue emerged in the past 2 months, it turned into a political issue. A lot of right-wing Pakistani religious parties have made it into a campaign where, in their view, it shows the American arrogance, the American indifference to Pakistani lives. And they are kind of politically cashing on it. It has put the Pakistani civilian government in a very difficult situation where it will have immense political repercussions if they publicly side with the Americans and release this guy. We really have no real clue into what the Pakistani military is thinking, because we now know that the guy who was arrested had some kind of intelligence connection.
Now, if we look at the situation with the Shahbaz Bakhti, Radio Free Europe did an interview recently with Michael Horowitz, who is a close friend of his, and he's also a specialist on religious freedom at the Hudson Institute in Washington. Why don't we take a listen to what Michael Horowitz had to say about the role that Pakistan's civil society could have, or whether it has the ability to respond meaningfully to Bhatti's assassination?
One of the things he did as Minister of Minority Affairs was set up around 120 district committees, harmony committees of six Muslims and six non-Muslims, who regularly met with each other and began to understand each other's issues and created that kind of civil society community. Shahbaz deeply believed that there really was this impulse. And yet, here was the United States giving $5 billion or so a year to Pakistan. Did anybody in the United States say, hey, we're giving you $5 billion, you better make sure that $20 million goes to the Ministry of Minority Affairs to help strengthen these harmony committees? No.
So you hear Michael Horowitz's criticism there of the United States government for not attaching some conditions for this aid to Pakistan. What are your thoughts on his comments?
If you look at it from Pakistani government's perspective, it would again be a politically sensitive issue. It will again play into the hands of religious extremists who will again project the Pakistani government as some kind of a stooge in the hands of what they call the Zionist Christian powers. But I agree with Michael that the minority, the religious minorities in particular, but also the ethnic minorities in Pakistan, are in a very difficult position, and there is a lot that needs to be done.
What about the prospects for the Taliban in Pakistan for a comeback? Do you see that Pakistan's Taliban is in a situation now where they appear to be making a comeback?
What had happened with the Pakistani Taliban, their ability to capture and hold onto large swaths of Pakistani territory, huge regions, districts, tribal agencies or tribal districts, has somehow been degraded by military operations in the past 2 years. The most successful, of course, was the operation in Swat. But there were operations in Bajor and in South Waziristan. What has not happened is that there is no political approach to deal with them. Again, Taliban in Pakistan is more of a generic name than really one specific organization. And of course, Pakistan's policy towards Afghan Taliban is very vague. And of course, there are all kinds of disagreements between Pakistan and NATO, Pakistan and Washington in particular, about the way forward in Afghanistan. And I think that Pakistani Taliban are clearly very cleverly exploiting those disagreements, these kinds of gray areas, the vagueness in policy. Their ability to control large territories has been downgraded, but they are very capable, as we are seeing right now, of pulling off spectacular attacks, which usually results in large-scale killing of civilians.
Ron Sinovitz and Abubakar Sadiq talking about the rising violence in Pakistan. For more on Pakistan, visit RFE's Gandhara blog at rferl.org. Just a reminder that The Blender is the new weekly podcast from Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. RFERL brings radio, internet, and television news programming to 21 countries across the former Soviet Union, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iran, Iraq, and the Balkans. The Blender is practically a tween now. This is our 9th episode, and we'd love to hear from you how we're doing. So drop us a line at podcast@rferl.org or by leaving a comment on our website. And remember, you can download episodes of The Blender from our website or by subscribing on iTunes. A new episode is posted every Friday.
Говорить радіо Свобода.
Радіо Фарда гуш میکنید.
Машал радіо Дамілі
Аутун ДТМ.
Радіо Авакно.
28 languages, 21 countries, one voice. Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty.
With 20 local bureaus in our broadcast countries, we're lucky to have some pretty interesting people visiting our studios. Our colleagues in Tatarstan recently hosted one such person in their bureau in the capital, Kazan. Islam Valiyev is an economics major at Kazan State University, and he's also gained distinction as the so-called Tatar beatbox. You can check out a video of Valiyev performing his magic by hitting the link at the Blender section of rfdrl.org or by visiting the website of our Tatar Bashkir language service at azatlik.org. That's azatlik.org. And finally, a look at International Women's Day, which marked its 100-year anniversary on March 8th. The holiday has its origins in the labor movements of the United States and Europe, but it's places like Russia and other post-communist countries where commemorations remain an important part of the social calendar, even today. March 8th has a flowers and chocolate aspect to it, much like Valentine's Day or Mother's Day, but it's also become a time for examining the continued challenges facing women in many parts of the world. I sat down earlier this week with three of my female colleagues to talk about Women's Day in their countries. I'm joined today by Zamira Ishanova of our Uzbek service, Amina Umarova of our North Caucasus service, and Farah Hiwad of our Afghan service. And I wanted to start with Zamira and Amina, who both grew up in the former Soviet Union, Zamira in Uzbekistan and Amina in Chechnya. And this is a part of the world where March 8th is a very big deal. Although it's not necessarily very political, it's a day where there's a lot of chocolates, a lot of flowers, and a lot of celebrating. So, Amina, why don't we start with you? What are some of your memories when you were growing up of March 8th?
I remember that the boys, they collected money, I know, before March 8th, when we were like kids. And we started like getting like for the gifts. It's a small dolls, flowers, chocolate. And when we grow up, so it ended with perfume. In Soviet time, if you remember, it was really difficult to get the good one. And I remember that in the 10th, in my last grade, it was perfume.
Zamira, what about you?
Yeah, Daisy, I grew up in a big family where seven members were female, and only my father and my young brother were just male. So I remember this day, it was exceptional visit by my father to the kitchen, and he was offering some, you know, oh, today you all, you know, should relax and I will cook for you. And my grandma and my mom, they were politely rejecting this offer because my father never, ever, you know, cooked anything. So they were pleased, of course, to hear that, but they never let him cook for these big celebrations. And it was, of course, a big celebration at home because, as I told you, you know, there were seven female members of family and we were getting really compliments and nice words, very nice treatment from the morning. And, of course, some flowers for my mom. And I remember at school it was a big deal. It's a kind of combination for Western Mother's Day and Valentine's Day, you know. And it used to be, and it's still. So we were preparing cards for our moms and giving it in the evening. And it was special songs, special poems. So it was very nice. I have very nice memories of these days.
The example you give of your father is a good one. The man going into the kitchen one time a year, yeah, trying to cook, failing miserably, yes, and the woman having to do the work,
yes,
anyway.
That's why my mom never loved my father.
It sounds like she made the right choice, but at least he was making,
yes,
the gesture.
Yes.
And Fatima, what about in Chechnya? I'm curious, was that a day when men would go into the kitchen and try to make dinner?
Actually, my father, he is kind of rejecting the only day in a year to go to the kitchen. He makes like amazing grill. And he does it all the time, and he said, it's not the only day I will do something for my woman. And he was kind of rejecting this day.
Farah, March 8th celebrations don't have the same history in your country.
Exactly.
Afghanistan. But Afghanistan is one of the countries that's really come into focus, mm-hmm, particularly this year on the 100th anniversary of International Women's Day, because it is a place where women face incredible difficulties.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the most serious challenges that Afghan women are facing today?
The most serious challenges are security, insecurity, and also poor economy. Because if they don't have a security, they cannot go to schools, they cannot achieve higher education. This is one problem. And poor economy also, it's linked to their, it affects their health. Like the Afghan women, big challenge is maternal health issue. Like every year, according to a survey, every year like 24,000 women die giving birth while they give a birth. So this is a very big challenge. So it is related to economy.
Mm-hmm. It's especially difficult, I imagine, because it hasn't been that long since the situation for women in Afghanistan was quite different. And as you were just telling me, mm-hmm. your mother and your aunts lived at a time when life was pretty good for women in Afghanistan. You were able to go to school, you were able to work. You yourself were able to go to medical school, although you weren't able to finish. Can you envision a time in the future in Afghanistan where women are going to be able to enjoy those same rights once again?
If in Afghanistan the security problem is solved, economy is okay, so I think the time will return for women, but I don't think so, at least not for me, maybe for next generation. Because those time, like my mom and my aunties lived, they called it like a golden time for women. Because my mom, my aunties, they had more liberty, they had more freedom than I had. Because my time was very difficult time during the school, during the university. But I think women will live in fear and oppression for a long time because it is security. Even though, like, since 2001, many efforts were put to make the women condition improve. But still, like, in big cities, it's okay for women. But in the countryside, women still facing big problems. Just yesterday, we had a report like in the Baghlan province, which is in the north, just within 1 year, 19 women committed suicide.
And they do it very often in probably the most horrifying way, isn't that right?
Yeah.
Through
they burn themselves like in Herat. Within 2 years, 180 women burned themselves just to flee the abuse from the in-laws or from the parents, and still there's like a underage marriage and a forced marriage. These things are still going on.
Amina, we know that the situation for women in Chechnya is also not very good, especially over the past couple of decades. There have been the two wars with Russia, and now we have a situation where the new president, Ramzan Kadyrov, is imposing new guidelines for the way that women have to behave in their family and in society. And among those are rules about how they have to dress. And he's trying to impose a new Islamic standard for dressing so that women have to wear headscarves, they have to wear long sleeve shirts and long skirts. And what do you think? What is he trying to do? Is he trying to weaken the position of women?
I don't think that he will be successful even if he wants to, you know, even if he's going to weaken Chechen women's position, because in many, many thousand years, Chechen women play a very important role in Chechen society. Chechen women has always got an equal rights like men has. And I remember even the time when my grandma came into the room, an elderly man, they, you know, stood up because it was a great respect. My other grandma from my mom's mom, she's still alive, thank God. She's 84 years now. And I know that the whole family all the time goes to her to ask for the advice. And once I remember my mom wanted my dad go to take the position, the head of college position. And she was discussing in my with my grandma, and she was listening, and it said, okay, but why don't you go to this position? And my mom said, no, I don't have time. I have kids. And she said, so and what? Only 5 kids, so you can handle it. Just go there. And my mom... And my mom became the head of the college, and my father, he was offered another good job.
So you're describing women in Chechnya as playing an extremely strong role within the family.
It has always been. And why we survived in two horrible wars because of Chechen women. They saved lives of hundreds of thousands of men. And I think Ramzan Kadyrov himself, we can see that he respects his mom a lot, and he respects women too. But he's a simple village boy, and he sees his mom, that she wears longer sleeves and covers her head with a scarf, and he wants, it's like the ideal model of Chechen woman for him.
Amina, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Zamira, we tend to think of Uzbekistan as being a politically repressive country across the board for all of its citizens. But what about the women in particular? What is it like to be a woman in Uzbekistan? Are there particular problems or challenges that they face?
Yeah, they see in Uzbekistan the situation is repressive, not only, you know, toward women or men, it's, you know, the same. But as a woman, you know, I left my country 16 years ago, not because of these political problems of my country, but mostly because how society sees women, you know, and how they expect women to behave. Society expects you to be obedient to your father, who is now, you know, from the childhood kind of autocratic ruler of the family, and then you should prepare, and your family prepares you to be obedient wife and obedient in law. And I'm afraid it's still the same. Society wants, you know, it's a kind of very traditional society and wants to keep this kind of role for women for the future generations. If you watch Uzbek TV, they always try to somehow insert this kind of mentality. They support because it supports kind of the political doctrine of the establishment. But at the same time, this poverty and socioeconomic situation is forcing millions of women to leave Uzbekistan in search for better work or become kind of labor migrants in other countries. And now they're exposed to different cultures, to different rules, to different lifestyles. And so, and they're earning their money now because it's a matter of survival. So this is also slowly changing the mentality. And women, when they return to Uzbekistan, now they cannot accept these rules. Now they cannot be obedient because they are now bread earners for the family. So that's why I think this is changing. These rules they have to change in because of this pressure from socioeconomic and whatever change in the country.
As you said, you've been here for many years, and I think you've succeeded. I'm not sure anyone would describe you as obedient. You're a very independent, strong-minded person. And I wanted to ask you, as a Westerner myself, I think I automatically assume that women who come from one part of the world to the West automatically feel freer and more comfortable. But perhaps that's a misperception on my part. Maybe I have a Western bias. What do you think? Do you feel more comfortable here?
Daisy, you have. I think Americans have a very good saying, you can take a girl out of the town, but you cannot take her out of the girl. So it's very difficult adoption to this kind of freedom and to this kind of liberal values. Though I told you, you know, I always assumed myself being very much liberal, very much untraditional, you know, very much kind of progressive or things like that, but finding yourself in a completely different culture, in a different value systems, it takes time to adopt. But what is a freedom? Freedom should come from within, right? So there are a lot of rules which is sitting in my back mind, you know, which is voice of my grandma, which is a voice of my mom, which might be voice of my neighboring women. Again, saying good woman should be a good wife, and then good daughter-in-law, serving the family and serving her husband. This is a priority. And so these kind of rules are still sitting, you know, but the voices are getting lower.
Quieter.
So that's why to find this freedom within yourself while you are in a maybe de facto in a kind of free society, it's a different challenge and it's a different process. So yes, I found myself being free, much more free than in Uzbekistan, but it took me years what to do with this freedom.
And that's all we've got. I'm Daisy Sindelar, and thanks for turning on the blender from Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. We'll close with the soundtrack from the 1981 Soviet television show, Take Care of the Women. Have a great week.